So my guest today is Lee Kenny. Lee Kenny is a friend of mine and a journalist. He's formerly at the Birmingham Evening Mail and now resides in New Zealand, where he works on a paper called The Press in Christchurch. Lee was brought up in the Midlands, in Walsall and in Birmingham. And also, while he was living in England, taught media, film and journalism at both the University of Wolverhampton and the University of Kent. Lee is also the founder of the Facebook group Film Academics UK, which has about 450 members and is a lively forum for all manner of film related topics. And Lee is joining me today from New Zealand, so obviously the sound quality of this podcast will reflect that. So I wanted to think about a little bit about the representation of the Midlands, the West Midlands specifically, on screen. And something that was pointed out to me quite recently was a British sitcom called A Man Like Mobeen, starring and written by Guz Khan. Set in Small Heath in Birmingham, about a man who is a Muslim man who has a past as a drug dealer and is now going straight and is looking after his younger sister.
And the first series is now on Netflix over here, and also on the iPlayer. What were your thoughts on Man Like Mobeen?
Yeah, I enjoyed it very much, James. And it was something I was kind of half aware of, but actually really enjoyed having a reason to kind of sit down and catch up on. And so it's kind of set in the Small Heath area of South Birmingham. And it's an interesting place, actually. And quite a lot of the things that make it interesting are explored within the show. But, I mean, as a sitcom, it was very enjoyable. I think, you know, the characters work very well. And at the same time, it does have a bit of an edge to it. I think it doesn't shy away from some of the issues that that particular community, that particular part of Birmingham has faced. So, yeah, kind of hats off to it, really. You know, there are obvious comedy characters and, you know, certain stuff that's just obviously played for laughs. But at the same time, you know, it does deal with things like knife crime and immigration and radicalization and, you know, issues that part of the world, you know, faces on a semi-regular basis. So I was very impressed, actually, by the way that it's used. You know, Guz Khan, he's kind of used comedy as a vehicle to explore, lots of those issues.
Yeah, I agree. I think I have real issues with the kind of single camera format for sitcoms. I don't think it works very well for comedy. I'm not aiming that at Man Like Mobeen. I mean, it's a feature of all kind of sitcoms nowadays. I don't think the single camera works as well as a studio based sitcom, or where they're allowing the performances to work in kind of long takes. So you've got the timing. Mm-hmm. The timing is created in a studio based sitcom. Or a long take format. Mm-hmm. The comic timing is created through the performances rather than through the editing. And so I always find it kind of loses something a little bit. The timing of the gags isn't quite as good and isn't quite as sharp as an old sitcom. And I think Man Like Mobeen, you know, does have a little bit of that, despite the fact that it's also, you know, it is pretty funny and it's got, I really like the performances. Very, very charismatic people.
Yes.
You know, Guz Khan especially. Really kind of interesting guy. Seems to be a kind of up-and-coming figure. You probably haven't seen them, but he was on an ad for crisps featuring the Spice Girls over
right,
here
no, re- I haven't. Re- re- re-
recently.
Okay.
Yeah, so like...
Okay.
And so he's in stuff, and he seems to... I think he came from doing stuff on YouTube, then he was kind of picked up from that. So that's fascinating, and I think it's good.
Yeah, I think the first thing I saw of him actually was a YouTube clip that was doing the rounds where he was talking about Jurassic Park film was.
That's correct.
I saw him on that, and that was kind of good. And then good that he's kind of been picked up, and I think you know there's real depth there. And I think the way that they've kind of positioned him within that world alongside his sister and alongside his friends, I think that's good, actually. And it's actually a sitcom that will probably only get better. Because it's very short, isn't it? It's like two seasons so far, mm-hmm. with like short episodes. But I think actually, as it's given time to grow, I think it really will. It's a potential to be something very good.
Yeah, and I hope it does in a way. I haven't seen the second series. I've only seen the first series, so you've probably got a better understanding of how it develops into season two. I do like, even though, despite what I said about the single camera problem, what I consider to be a problem, it is a pretty well shot series as well. And I like some of the kind of like the locations that they use. I think one of the very first shots, you've got like a kind of tower block in the background. Then we've got a scene under a bridge. This is the first episode, and then they live in that terraced house with the kind of settee in the front yard. And I like all that kind of detail. It's kind of got a real kind of class-based focus, as well as it being about, you know, the BME communities, the Muslim especially in Birmingham, but also, you know, it speaks to kind of the working class generally, I think, and working class life generally, which I think was really interesting, and which I don't think is you see enough of in sitcoms these days. Yeah.
I'd say there's a real authenticity to it, actually, and like the details you described there, like the location, some of the observations, are probably a big part of that authenticity. I think he's from Coventry, so just down the road from Birmingham, but obviously, yeah, I mean, he knows that world well enough. Interesting to, I'd be curious as to know why he chose Small Heath, rather than setting it in his native Coventry. I don't know what the logic behind that was. They're probably only 10 or 12 miles apart, Coventry and Birmingham, but two very distinct cities, you know, with a clear identity. But, you know, Small Heath is a place that kind of ends up on the news for all the wrong reasons, and from time to time, at least. But at the same time, it's an interesting, you know, it's kind of interesting to hear you kind of talk about the working class representation, because I did a little bit of research on Small Heath. So when I was a journalist in Birmingham, Small Heath was part of the patch that I covered, and there's some areas around there that are a really nice snapshot of working class Birmingham, and you've got streets like Lady Paul Road, not far from where this sitcom is set, where it's a brilliant snapshot of like 1950s Irish immigration, then 1960s subcontinental immigration, and if you go there now, you'll see a lot of people from East Africa, and it's, yeah, the road itself is like a brilliant snapshot of all these different waves of immigration. And what tends to happen is that, you know, the first generation kind of move into these areas. By the second generation, they've, you know, kind of moved out to other areas, and, you know, other working class people have kind of moved in their place. So yeah, it is good. And it reminded me, I don't know if this is a leap too far, James, by all means tell me if it is. It's not.
I will tell you, don't worry.
Thank you, James. It's not too dissimilar to Only Fools and Horses in its dynamic as well. And, you know, there are some real similarities between, you know, life in, you know, modern day Small Heath and life in 1980s Peckham, and, you know, the relationship between Mobeen and his sister, Asker, not too dissimilar to Del and Rodney. And I think, you know, given enough time, I hope, you know, given enough time for it to flourish, I think it will sit quite well alongside Fools and Horses.
That's a really interesting point. I hadn't considered the similarity yet there with the older brother and the younger sister, who's the brother's obviously considerably older than than the sister as well. That's not something I'd considered at all. But you think you're absolutely right. There is an element of that to it, and also the kind of like the shady characters, and, you know,
exactly,
not buying stuff off the market, but buying stuff off, you know, buying a laptop in a bin liner from somebody in a car. That kind of stuff. So that's a really good observation.
I mean, that could be Trigger, couldn't it? That could have been an episode where Trigger's bought something off a bloke, and it just didn't even cross his mind to look in the bag, that kind of thing. So, some similarities there. And I think the second season, one of the continuing plot lines is him trying to get. It turns out he's not actually the sort of official guardian of his sister. So that's a kind of a plot line that they go down to him kind of becoming, you know, formally responsible for her. And the edge that I talked about really kind of comes into play towards the end of the second series, where they're kind of one of his friends gets out of prison. Some of the local gangsters who I think are in the first series kind of come back. And, you know, in the way that Fools and Horses obviously kind of played itself for laughs, from time to time there would be, you'll probably know the name of the episode, James, the one with the Driscoll brothers where yeah. Delboy gets a hiding and that kind of stuff. And in the second series, you know, it does get nastier.
Interesting.
You know, in the way that Fours and Horses would from time to time. So yeah, I think some comparisons there, but at the same time, you know, it stands up in its own right as well, I think, as something, you know, a new take on a new place, even though it's a, you know, a standard format for TV.
Yeah, that's really interesting points. Yeah. So one thing you mentioned there as to why you set it in Small Heath and not Coventry, and I wonder whether this is down to the kind of paucity of the representations of the West Midlands anyway. People yes. don't know Coventry in the way that they've heard of Small Heath. They've heard of Birmingham, as you say, maybe making the news for the wrong reasons. So maybe that's one of the reasons why they picked Small Heath, because it was a more recognisable place. The other series that's set in the West Midlands currently that's very popular is, of course, Peaky Blinders, which I know you're a fan of. You've seen most of the episodes, is that correct?
Yes, I think I'm fully up to date. Yeah, seen it, like it. Yeah, big fan. I think it first aired in 2013, and I think I remember at the time, actually, I remember a little bit of scepticism. I remember a little bit of sneeriness about the idea of a Birmingham-based gangster drama, and in actual fact, it's been a phenomenon. And you know, in terms of actually the quality of the show, its cultural impact, you know, I remember the first time I read an article saying that kind of Peaky Blinders haircuts, you know, would be the thing to have, thinking, really, that seems like a bit of a stretch. You know, now you see it commonly. And, you know, the look of those guys has become, you know, something that shows, you know, the show's exported. Set in Small Heath as well. Yeah, so not just set in the Midlands, but set in exactly the same place.
As, oh, really?
Yeah, absolutely set in the same place. So I don't believe much of it is filmed in Birmingham, and I think that was one of the kind of the criticisms of the first few series, was that it was kind of Birmingham based, but I think lots of the production was it might have been you know, some of it was off in Liverpool, I think. Like I think they've since done more filming in the Midlands, so the Black Country Museum in Dudley is frequently used. I think. Obviously, it's a period piece, and much of that area of Birmingham was flattened during the war. So there's, you know, there literally aren't the buildings now, mm-hmm. you know, to recreate 1920s Birmingham or 1930s as the most recent series is. But yeah, exactly set in the same place. You know, there'll be frequent references to St Andrews, to the Bullring, to Gash Street Basin. You know, these will all be places that if you're from Birmingham, you'll be familiar with, and you know. Like in Man with Mobeen, you see him down by the canal, as you mentioned, under the bridges and stuff like that. And Peaky Blinders, has really, you know, I'm obviously living in New Zealand at the moment, and if I say, you know, I grew up in Warsaw, so not a million miles away from Birmingham, but I'll say I'm from Birmingham because it's the nearest big city, and quite often the first thing that gets said is, you know, are you a fan of Peaky Blinders? So this is internationally the film. Internationally, the show, you know, has been great for the city, and I think it's been good for Birmingham having that show, and you know, obviously this the, you know, the sitcom as well, to see it on screen represented in a very positive way.
So, how do you think though about? I mean, I haven't seen all of Peaky Blinders, but and I know this is probably a common criticism, so I'm saying nothing new here. What is your thinking about the accents? Why are the accents in it so variable? Now, these people are some of the best actors in the world are in this stuff.
Yeah.
So why is it so difficult for them to do a Birmingham accent? Now, do you think that is a conscious decision on behalf of the producers to tone down the way the Midlands accent sounds?
It's a curious one, and it's almost the one thing I have to overlook when I watch Peaky Blinders, and almost find myself kind of making allowances for it. Like I think in season two you meet Tommy Shelby's dad and he's Irish, well therefore, you know, that kind of makes sense that kind of Cillian Murphy might sound a little bit Irish. So Helen McClory's sometimes sounds Scouse, sometimes sounds a bit South African, but you know, even now I'll kind of try and justify, you know, she's this matriarchal figure, you know, maybe she as a character is deliberately trying not to talk like she's from working class Birmingham. So, you know, I've gone a long way to try and accept this. In terms of the actual practical realities of it, I mean, I think they have actually gone back and cast Birmingham actors. So you do hear sort of authentic Birmingham accents in it. So, I mean, although that's good, sometimes that also, you know, just highlights the fact that some of them don't sound like they've ever been to Birmingham.
Right.
It's a curious one. Stephen Knight, that wrote it, from just outside of Birmingham, Streatley, in Warsaw. I've heard him interviewed kind of saying stuff like he really likes the Birmingham accent, that it's, you know, he kind of really likes the sound of it. It's very masculine sound and kind of born out of the industry and stuff like that. So I think all that stuff, you know, is you know, hearing that stuff's good, that, you know, that it should be celebrated, that it's a product of the hard environment that people lived in. But at the same time, I suppose, that, you know, they just cast people nationally, internationally to come in and, you know, especially in the first series when they weren't actually filming in Birmingham, I don't think. Maybe they just overlooked that. I don't know. Or maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe, you know, maybe it's just the intimate knowledge that you or I have that kind of makes it sound. I'm sure people I work with here aren't bothered if, you know, if they don't sound like they're from Birmingham, because, you know, they sound like they've got an accent, and therefore it's, you know, to an American audience, an international audience, maybe it's just not worth worrying about.
Well, I mean, in terms of the drama, it almost certainly isn't. Worth worrying about, but I wonder whether, I mean, it'd be difficult to imagine a drama set in London, in East London, that doesn't at least attempt some form of London accent, or a London accent that everyone recognises. Like I'm sure genuine EastEnders may have a problem with the way people talk in EastEnders,
yeah.
But I suppose the point is, it's recognisably an East London, or recognisably a London accent. Whether that's the genuine article, it's accepted as the genuine article. In a way that, because there's such a lack of representation on screen of the West Midlands, is that there's no genuine, authentic, accepted way of presenting that. And so you get this just variety of accents. I mean, nobody seems to be able to... has any problem pulling off a Birmingham accent when they're taking the piss, right?
No, that's... how good is the accent when they're taking the piss? No,
but it's funny, at least.
It's that kind of... it's that kind of... I'm trying to think of the examples. You know, it's the, you know, we want to be together, you know, that yeah. advert, whatever that was an advert for, and that... is that kind of lazy, brummy... you know, kind of the shorthand for stupidity by doing that kind of exaggerated accent.
Well, that's the point, though, isn't it? The point is so they're avoiding the actors doing that. So to try and avoid the fact that there's this stereotype of you're a bit dim and you're a bit stupid if you've got that accent. So I wonder...
Oh, that's interesting. I genuinely never thought that, if I'm honest. I'd always just assumed that it was too difficult rather than it being an attempt to try and, like... avoid. I'd never given it that thought. I mean, you know that part of the world well. I would like to say you're from Wolverhampton. Is that that's nice?
Yes, that's fine.
Okay, so I mean, obviously, you're from probably what, 20 miles away from Birmingham.
Gotcha.
But a Black Country accent, completely different to a Birmingham accent. You know, markedly different in terms of the use of the words and the dialect. So maybe when you grow up around it, it seems more straightforward than it is. Actually, maybe you know, there is something about hearing it on a regular basis that kind of attunes you to a Birmingham accent that actually, if you're not from there, is difficult to replicate, perhaps.
Yeah, thank you.
And maybe the fact that you don't hear it very often, I don't know. Maybe the fact that maybe the scarcity of use means that it's harder to pull off, I don't know.
Thanks for that. I mean, I was just throwing the question out there, really, more than anything else. And partly because it's so rare that you see it on screen. Although that is changing.
Going back to Mabin, though, I'd definitely say, I mean, like, you hear absolute authenticity in the way that they speak in that.
Agreed.
You do. I mean, those people are from that. They are without a doubt from Birmingham. It's not that they're you know, from Liverpool, which is better actors than you know, the ones in Peaky Blinders. Like they absolutely talk like you would expect people to talk like from South Birmingham.
I completely agree. I think there is an authenticity to it, and I wrote on my notes before we started speaking that Man Like Mabeen had an edge too. I use that exact phrase. So it was, yeah. You know, we both picked up on that, and. Yeah, and as you say, Gus Kahn is originally from Coventry, so kind of just up the road from Birmingham. And I don't know if you've seen the film that came out 2-3 years ago, that The Hitman's Bodyguard with Samuel L. Jackson and Ryan Reynolds.
I did not. No,
well,
I mean,
at one point, they have to take some I don't know, international arms dealer or something, who's on trial for war crimes, and they stop off in Coventry, of all places.
Really?
I don't know. Okay. They don't actually film it. They don't film it in Coventry.
Right. Okay.
So I've got no idea, but it was just interesting that they mentioned that on screen, and they took the time out to mention it on screen rather than just coming up with something else. But not a very good film that stars Samuel L. Jackson. And here you go. He has this for a link. And also wanted to talk about the new 2019 Netflix version of Shaft, starring Samuel L. Jackson. but just because I have a kind of passing interest in blaxploitation from the 1970s, and I was a big fan of the John Singleton version of Shaft from 2000, with again Samuel L. Jackson and Christian Bale and Toni Collette. Amongst many other actors, Jeffrey Wright is in that film. Really underrated, kind of almost forgotten film now. So what were your thoughts on the new version of Shaft, the 2019 version that has just come out on Netflix?
Okay, well, so, I mean, in full transparency, I mean, I probably wouldn't have watched it if you hadn't have said this would be an interesting talking point. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, blaxploitation is an area, you know, kind of far better than I do. But I don't know if I'm allowed to say that you and I have known each other for a good number of years now. So I remember when the first Shaft film came out, and I don't think I've seen it since the cinema. I remember you being a fan of it then. Also remember you kind of talking about the kind of the simplicity of the plot as well. It's that, you know, it's a man who's beaten to death after an altercation in a bar, kind of gets out of hand. So it's quite a low-key film.
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's quite complex. I mean, it's kind of sober. You've got the social conscience about it. It's, of course, it's a race based murder where you've got this kind of rich kid played by Christian Bale, a very privileged person who's killed a black person outside a bar, and you've also got this kind of then linked to a kind of Hispanic drug gang and police corruption. Right, so it's not a kind of action comedy that's played for laughs. It's not like they resurrected the 70s thing like they did with the version with the remake of Starsky and Hutch, where they made it a kind of it's not like that at all. It's a very complex piece of work as regards and a very, as you say, low-key plot and really quite interesting in what they try and do. They don't try and make it a kind of Shaft taking on the world and looking effortlessly cool.
Exactly that. Yeah. So when I kind of said it was low key, it was just, you know, just this premise that you know, this is something that actually could happen.
Yeah.
This isn't, he wasn't going up against, you know, former KGB agents or anything like that. They could have blown the whole thing out of proportion. Actually, I remember it being quite a severe film. And, you know, as you said, you know, it's actually a film that's, you know, obviously no surprise that kind of John Singleton used it as a vehicle to kind of, you know, look at race and racism and so having gone back and watched this new version, which weirdly they didn't even give it like an additional title, did they?
No.
I mean, it's a curious film in so many ways.
Yeah, there are now three films called Shaft.
Yeah, very strange.
And they're all sequels of each other. They haven't, so it's really bizarre.
That's a good point. So it's a strange film, and what they've done is the complete opposite of what they didn't do with the last one. Is, I mean, they've obviously kind of used this. Is it supposed to be like the start of? I mean, it felt like a TV pilot.
I thought it was when I first saw the trailer for this. I saw the trailer for this on Twitter, and I genuinely thought it was like it was a TV series that they were bringing out.
Felt a lot like that. Yes. And so whether they thought this was going to be, you know, the first of the start of a franchise, but it's definitely, you know, it is played as an action comedy. It is played as a kind of an intergenerational comedy where he's this kind of, you know, the first time his son, so the premise is that he's got this son who was actually never mentioned in the first film, but has kind of grown up in another part of America. He's not had any contact with him. He sends him presents on his birthday once a year. He sends him a pack of condoms, doesn't he, on his 17th birthday. He sends him some porno mags when he goes off to university. But the son needs to investigate the murder of one of his friends, so contacts his dad for help. He knocks on the door, and the first time, well, actually, the person that opens the door is like a bare-breasted woman, isn't it, that's kind of been around with John Shaft Sr. I mean, like, so that's kind of very markedly 70s, I thought. But then you've got the son who kind of plays it as this kind of millennial, you know, this very kind of awkward millennial character.
Very sensitive.
Yeah, almost kind of like, was it kind of that guy, is it Carlton in The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air? That kind of reminded me of him, you know, that kind of like kind of buttoned down, you know, kind of like intellectual, and loads of it's played for laughs. So it's a weird film, very weird. I mean, not unenjoyable, but certainly weird, and with some weird things in it as well. Like, you know, when we finally get the Richard Roundtree cameo, which I distinctly remember in that first film, him saying Uncle John. I only saw that film once at the cinema, but Richard Roundtree's cameo in that definitely is his uncle.
It is,
and in this one, they've kind of retrofitted this kind of narrative whereby actually he was his dad. But he used to pretend he was his uncle. I mean, very. I mean, at least they went back and acknowledged that. But they also need to try and. So now it's three generations of the family. I guess that's ultimately what they wanted. They didn't want two generations and an uncle. That didn't fit, you know, together quite as well.
But I wonder where they thought this was going. I mean, Samuel L. Jackson's 70 years old.
Exactly. He's only 6 years younger than Richard Roundtree.
Right. And so they're playing him as this kind of like. Alpha male. And it's really weird why in terms of Samuel Jackson's career, he's still maintaining this. I mean, this kind of... And in that Captain Marvel film, they had to, like, make him younger with the CGI, which looked excellent. And you think if they're going to do that, then the man could have a career till... Well, whenever. He could never stop, even after he's dead. Right.
I mean, imagine it's quite expensive to do that every time, but like so.
It'll get cheaper though.
Well, yeah, fair enough. No, that's true. That's true. I mean, it did make me think watching this film. It's been a long time since I saw an actual Samuel L. Jackson film. It feels like he crops up in so many films. I haven't watched all the Marvel films, but the last time I actually saw him on screen for any length of time. But yeah, a weird one. They then obviously have to try and make up for the fact that he's only 6 years younger than his supposed dad, with that line about him looking 20 years older. So they've created some problems for themselves, no doubt.
I mean, he doesn't look 70, it's fair to say. So, like, he's not supposed to be playing a man who's 70, but I guess he's supposed to be playing a man who's 50 or 50.
He says he's 60, yeah.
Oh, is that what he says? Okay.
They definitely say he's 60.
Okay.
But, yeah, I mean, it is strange how they've kind of shoehorned in the son. And, you know, the son's not just anybody. He's an FBI analyst. And, he's trying to investigate this conspiracy. Which you know, the total opposite of everything we just said about the first film. In this one, it is an international, some kind of international drug smuggling racket that's involving, you know, ex-Iraqi war veterans and the like. So, very, very, very interesting film for lots of reasons. Not all of them good, but not all of them bad.
I mean, personally, I felt it was pretty unwatchable, really. I mean, I like films about old men, you know, who still got it more than anyone. Right.
Yeah.
But this is just unbelievable. I mean, some of the I wonder who it's aimed at, really. I mean, guess it's aimed at people like me and people who are older, who somehow think they're getting one on kind of young men, and this kind of phrase millennials. I don't even know what age you're supposed to be as a millennial. I think you can probably be into your 30s, can't you? And still be a millennial.
Maybe from 82 onwards or something. Right. Like 85 onwards.
And so, like, you know, you've got this stuff, and it would work if it was funny, but it really isn't when he's kind of, you know, trying to educate his son on how to be a man. And half the time you're thinking, you know,
you know, his son's right. You know, he's kind of got it right first time. The joke isn't, the joke's on the son, it feels like, and not on Shaft.
Absolutely, yes.
And I think that's what makes it really, really weak for me. And I'm really sympathetic to that kind of unreconstructed masculinity and the celebration of that in cinema. I think that's, you know, really fun. But this just really didn't work for me. You know, the performances, the performers in it are really good. I think all the actors in it are really good actors. So it would be good to see them doing stuff that's a little bit better. I mean, it just felt like there was a load of scenes in clubs and restaurants. Every fight scene or shootout has like a crowd around them, where just watching them do what they're doing, just so they can kind of show off, you know. And I think it's yet another of these Netflix films. I don't know whether it was made for Netflix or it was like just bought by Netflix, that are just really poor, really weak pieces of work, really kind of like TV standard production values, just really weak, you know. I thought, you know, for given the talent that's involved in terms of on screen and the budget, you know.
Yeah, I don't really know what a Netflix original means. I mean, it used to mean that they just bought, so you know, they'd gone to Sundance Film Festival and, you know, bought a ton of stuff in that nobody else did. But I don't know if they're actually involved. Are they commissioning stuff? I mean,
yeah,
I have
they
no
do.
Idea
yeah.
Whether actually, right? Okay. So at what point this got off the ground? I mean, having Sam Jackson in a film would be, you know, is not nothing. You know, I think he's still a big name, but.
He is. He's apparently, if you count like the Marvel films and his popularity in that, he's one of the most bankable stars who's probably ever lived.
Yeah.
I mean, the amount of franchises he's been involved in, you know, in terms of like even like Star Wars and, you know, the Tarantino stuff. I mean, he's absolutely huge, you know, and rightly so. I mean, he's a great performer and brilliant to watch on screen, you know. And he does his business in this, doesn't he? He does his stuff, and you know, it's not unlikable in that sense. But I'd just rather see him do it in another better film, you know. I thought his stuff in Captain Marvel was better. I thought even the Hitman's Bodyguard, if you managed to ever check that out, it's again a very weak film, but you've got Samuel L. Jackson and Ryan Reynolds who are good, very funny men, you know, and so there's something to be had for that, whereas this I'll never watch it again and hope I never come across it ever again, really.
And yet it exists in the same universe, doesn't it? So you've got like the three original Shaft films, and then you've got the 2001, and then you've got, this is a continuation of that world, isn't it? Same, you know, three generations now of private detective.
It's just a name. I mean, the Shaft name, I think, is just a name that they'll probably do another version of it in 10 years' time. Not with Samuel L. Jackson, with another upcoming or popular black actor. I wonder it's been mishandled as far as I'm concerned. And let's be honest, but the original Shaft from the 70s isn't very good. I mean, that's not a very good film. It's a very groundbreaking film, very important film, but it's not terribly good. It's not terribly effective in comparison with some of the other blaxploitation films at the time, which I think are far more interesting and far more effective and pieces of work, you know, like Superfly, for example. Is a much better piece of work in my opinion. So Shaft's never been all that good, as far as I'm concerned. But it is the big name for that type of thing. Yeah. You know?
And it's probably just another example of those kind of cinematic characters who, as soon as they kind of almost become public property, then you can there's like a noticeable decline in the standard. And you know, you get that with the John McClane films, you get that with the Terminator films, Alien, Predator. As soon as these things become larger than the films themselves, you know, how many Terminator films are we going to have to sit and watch? How many Predator films are we going to have to sit and watch? And they're all terrible. But as soon as they become, you know, iconic or, you know, pop culture, characters, then they'll just keep churning this stuff out. And I imagine that's probably the same with this. You know, it's just another example of something that kind of... Was the first Sam Jackson film an 18-rated film, do you think?
Shaft. I've got the DVD, but it's in a box somewhere. I can't go and get it. I think it is 18. I think it is 18 on the DVD, yeah.
And you'd probably just about get away. Maybe the swearing might disqualify it, but you could probably re-edit this one down to an easy 12A.
Yeah.
And that's what happens, isn't it? You get the first Terminator film is an 18. This, the last one was a 12A. The first Die Hard film was an 18. The most recent one was a 12A. Predator, Alien. So these things, they become kids' films. Now, there has been a bit of a move towards I think Deadpool and Logan have shown that, you can actually have a hard 18 film and it still be bankable. I believe the new Terminator film might be along those lines, although it will undoubtedly be terrible. Has these things become more famous? It just seems like it was just, let's get the ratings down. Let's get the 13-year-olds in to watch a Predator or to watch a Terminator movie. And, they're bloodless, goreless and pointless, really, aren't they? They're just and they're pointless to the fact that, the new Terminator film is a direct sequel to Terminator 2 and that kind of thing. So they just, not only were they bad, but cinema history will tell you that they didn't even exist, narratively. Now, I paid money to go and watch all those terrible films. I doubt I'm going to get that back. But they don't, those films don't exist in the context of their own narrative anymore. That's how bad they are.
So, sorry, can I ask a question? So that they've discounted the recent Terminator sequels. This new Terminator, they're marketing it as a direct sequel to Terminator 2 and discounting the others.
Yes, absolutely. So 3 and Salvation and Genesis don't exist as a result of this new one, which is a direct sequel to Terminator 2. They'll go to those lengths, just to strike this stuff from the record. It doesn't matter that, the last three films have been terrible because it's Terminator. And, to see that T-800... it's a powerful image on screen, and it's sadly been diluted with every film, but there's obviously still enough appeal for that character to rebirth the whole thing again.
I think, again, I wonder, I mean, I would imagine that this is a pure marketing decision here, so it doesn't really, they clearly don't care. We're not talking about them creating some kind of long form narrative that has any importance. So if you bring in Terminator 2, which is, I guess, regarded by fans of the franchise as maybe the best one, then you kind of like say, no, this time we're going to get it right. This time it counts. Please come back. We know the last ones were terrible, but please come back, because this time it's going to get it right. This is the real one. And whether it is or whether it isn't doesn't really matter. It'll probably, like the others, it'll probably be a 2-star film. Right.
Yes. Almost exactly certainly. That. And what they should have done at the end of Terminator 2 is there's that original deleted ending where it shows the guy that played John Connor at the start of the film. It kind of shows him without the scars on his face, and he's become like some kind of US senator or president or whatever. And that completely closed the loop on that narrative. And John was no longer the leader of the resistance, but he still became a leader in his own right. But there was no Judgment Day. They managed to avert it. But even then, they couldn't, they just couldn't stop themselves, could they? It was like, if we re-edit this with that, with that Linda Hamilton narrative about, the future is now unknown to us, it just means that we can cash in again as and when we want to. And yeah, but every time it's been awful.
Yeah, and I don't know why we're even moaning about this, to be honest. I mean, obviously the horse has bolted on all this business, and we should know better than to even complain about it. But I suppose it's the thought that this stuff could be so much better. This stuff could be so much more, with not actually that much more effort. It just seems to be that with the Terminator franchise, and I haven't seen many of the recent ones, the Predator ones, I kind of tuned out at the Alien versus Predator. It seemed to me they made actual conscious decisions to not make these films terribly meaningful and terribly good. I mean, these aren't films like, I can't stomach the Ridley Scott Prometheus, Covenant, Alien stuff. I can't stomach it, right? But he's clearly attempting to do something what he thinks is interesting. He's put a lot of effort and time into these things, right?
Yes.
Which I personally don't think is particularly successful, but other people do. And he does, right? Ridley Scott does. Whereas with the AVP stuff and some of these Terminator films, you think they've actively said, well, let's not spend too long on this. We don't need to spend any time producing this. We don't need to spend time writing it. We don't need to spend time casting it correctly. It doesn't matter. It's got the Terminator on it. It's got Aliens or Predator on it. That's all that matters. Let's just knock it out as fast as we can. And I like, you know, exploitation films and low budget films. I mean, that's, you know, my area. But I've got no time for when a big Hollywood studio does this and treats kind of people with just contempt, really, I suppose. And this stuff is trash because it's given no time or love, you know. And you know, I tuned out of Terminator and Predator a long time ago. And the last Predator was that was a Shane Black movie. Was that correct?
Well, exactly that. So yeah, I mean,
and I love Shane Black. I'm a huge fan of Shane Black. Absolutely, find him fantastic. But I couldn't. I mean, the trailer to that Predator film looked appalling, and I just couldn't be bothered to give it my time, quite frankly.
Yeah, and it's not good at all. It's very poor, actually. And then that kind of, you know, I take your point about actually these films aren't done with any real love or care. But, you know, you think somebody like he would invest time and love and care because he's, you know, so closely associated with it. But, you know, maybe these things actually worked well once. Maybe Predator worked well once, you know, when he was up against a group of special forces commandos in the jungle once. And actually, the more you see it, the more is that there was the one that was set on a predator planet. Was that called Predators? I don't even know. I've lost track myself. There was one that was set on a predator planet. Anyway,
is that Robert Rodriguez film?
Exactly. It was the Rodriguez film again. You know, these are people that you should be a safe pair of hands with this stuff. Mm-hmm. But there's a scene where it shows a group of predators around a campfire, and it's like, you know, less is more. I don't want to see these guys sitting around at the end of a hunt. Well, they're talking about their wives and their, you know, and their boss back home. You know, it's like, it's just, these weren't supposed to be personalities. And I think probably the more you've seen, the more they've tried to explain, is that bit in AVP where, you know, the alien, the predators give birth to the human race so that they can use this as vessels to breed the aliens. And so it's like, you know, so, yeah, on one hand, there is a total lack of thought. But then on the other hand, it's just, you know, if ever there was a film that needed less plot, you know, it's an Alien series. But yeah, you know, the John McClane films, you know, by the time you get to 5, you know, his son's special forces, you know, he's fighting Russians and all this kind of stuff, you know,
dreadful.
They just, yeah, absolutely dreadful.
Joyless, right? And joyless. I mean, I haven't got a problem with dreadful, but I have got a problem with joyless. And you know, that's the thing to me. And it's like, and like I said, and I'm going to reiterate my same point, it's because it's beyond a bad film, you know. You know, for all whatever faults they've got, whatever, whenever they make a James Bond film, it's, even if it goes wrong and it's not a particularly good one, they've still thrown absolutely everything at it. They've thrown all the money that they could at it. They've got the best cast that they could at the time. They've done everything they could within. You know, they've never just done it cheaply as a knockoff, right? There's still an attempt to make a good film there, and if. Uh-huh. You know, if one of the, and I'm not into the Marvel films at all, but if one of the Marvel films goes wrong, or even one of the kind of DC films goes wrong, it's not because they've been kind of like, they haven't put effort into it. It's because the effort's maybe gone into the wrong areas, or they've misguided, they haven't hired the right people. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't feel as if they've treated it with total contempt. Whereas some of these new Die Hard films, the new Terminator films, the new Predator films, do
Robocop remake, you know, just these films,
absolutely,
almost as if the hope is that the strength of that central pop culture figure is enough to get people there anyway. So let's just make it, you know, half decent will be good enough because people will watch it anyway because there's an appetite for those figures. So it's just, you know. Which is a shame because it does undermine, you know, the original. And in every single one of those cases, the original was great. You know, Die Hard, Predator, Robocop. And yeah, it's just, I suppose it's like a facsimile, isn't it? It's just every single version's a facsimile of the last. By the time you get to 5 films in, it kind of becomes harder and harder to recognise the original in what you're seeing.
And I do understand that as a natural kind of progression when it comes to a franchise and a series. Maybe that's natural and it can't be avoided. And maybe the stuff that we're complaining about here is about a kind of nostalgia for films you liked when you were growing up. And I dare say part of it is,
But it's just because it feels like there's very little attempt to try and make them good. That's the issue I have with it. Not that it's gone wrong or that it's a bit of a disaster. It's just that there's what they're doing with these films is deliberately producing mediocrity.
Yes.
They're not even aiming for any more than that, and that I think is the thing I find so offensive about them. But saying that, I don't watch them anymore, so why am I moaning really?
Yeah, I mean I've kind of reached a tipping point where I mean I don't go and see this stuff quite as avidly as I would have done once upon a time. I think, you know, the most recent, the Shane Black Predator film, I saw that on video, there you go, I saw that on DVD many months later. But yeah, there's still, I mean, the new Predator film was terrible. The new Terminator film, I don't know. I've probably reached the point now where actually I just can't. I know it's going to be 2 stars, and that's not enough for me to leave the house anymore. Whereas before, I would have just avidly gone along and, you know, enjoyed the bits I liked and not worried so much about the stuff that I didn't. But yeah, there you go. There's some fairly decent fan-made Predator films taking it in some interesting directions. There's one where he's kind of fighting. It's one set in medieval times. This guy comes back from the Crusades and hears talk of these demons in the forest. So he takes a team of about 6 of them, plus a Moor that he's kind of taken hostage, and the 6 of them go into the forest and fight a predator. You see a knight fighting a predator. So, I mean, that's, you know, just something new, you know, just something novel, you know, was exciting to see. So, that, you know, maybe there's room for that character to do things like that, but you know, we haven't had that on screen for a long time.
No, maybe we'll talk about the fan films another time, because there's some remarkable fan productions being made that you can find on YouTube around Star Wars and
definitely,
yes. I mean, just utterly remarkable pieces of work, and as you say, in some respects more interesting than the official franchises. But maybe that's a conversation for next time, when we can do a bit of research on this stuff leading up to it. Maybe we'll think about that for the next conversation, Lee.
Let's do that, yes.
Lee, thanks very much for your time.
It's been a pleasure, James. Thank you very much. Nice to speak to you.
Thank you.